This episode of Intelligent Medicine is brought to you by Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Nitric oxide is a vital signaling molecule in cardiovascular health. We all make nitric oxide in our bodies, but as we age, it starts to diminish naturally. Being proactive in maintaining nitric oxide levels is vital for healthful aging because an underperforming cardiovascular system will limit the effectiveness of any other supplementation in your regimen. Just two capsules of Berkeley Life daily provides the dietary nitrate equivalent of 7 ounces of beets and can support energy levels, maintain healthy blood pressure levels, and improve general circulation. It's the professional-grade nitric oxide supplement that I recommend and prescribe for my patients. This is only available from healthcare providers. To get your Berkeley Life professional supplements, just go to drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life. That's drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life. You can also get Berkeley Life's patented nitric oxide test strips to conveniently test your own nitric oxide levels safely and easily at home. That's drhoffman.com/Berkeley Life for Berkeley Life nitric oxide supplements. Welcome to today's Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer your questions. Radio program at AOL.com is the destination for questions. How you doing, Layla?
Okay, Dr. Hoffman, how are you?
Good, good. So in a bit of a sign of the times is that our Q&As with Layla over the past few weeks have been devoted entirely to coronavirus. And in the spirit of opening up, lifting of the lockdown, I guess it's a good sign that some of our questions today are not pertaining to coronavirus. It's a sign of normalization, right?
Yeah. It's a welcome change.
We're not getting that much in the way of normalization here in New York. However, both of us are ensconced in our shelters in New York. I'm in Midtown Manhattan. You're in Queens.
Yep.
And we're appropriately socially distancing via Skype today to record this. Mm-hmm. And what do you think? What do you think the prospects are for an unraveling here in New York City? I mean, unfortunately, New York City is the epicenter of this, and whereas certain parts of the country are opening up at the end of the month, there's no prospect for New York to have a major loosening of the regulations, right?
Well, it's too soon. I mean, if we're going to go by the guidelines of phase 1, 2, and 3, per the Trump administration, I think we're only a few days into a flatter curve.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to be in that or a downgrade or a downward slope for about 14 days.
Mm-hmm. To demonstrate
before consideration
Let's make that move. Let's wait and see, you know, if there's some very adverse outcomes. Like, for example, Singapore is a place that pretty much had this under wraps. And lately, there's been a really resurgence of cases there. And what they discovered in Singapore is that the general populace, first of all, a very affluent, disciplined place. You know, it's the kind of place where, you know, if you spit in the sidewalk or if you chew gum, you know, you can get, like a big monetary fine.
Yeah.
So it's it is a, quote, democratic, capitalistic society. However, it's a very much centralized control, command and control kind of government there. But what's happened is they have a lot of guest workers there. So that all the beautiful gleaming buildings and the clean municipal spaces there are maintained by some relatively poor guest workers. Some of them come from Bangladesh and places like that where, you know, they make, you know, what seems like royal wages when they work in Singapore. And they're not getting that much, but by the standards of the countries they come from, they're getting a lot of money. But they're housed in dormitories under very close conditions. And that's where 75% of the new cases are coming from, is among that guest worker population. So Singapore has to do some things now to quarantine those folks, unfortunately.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's kind of like learn as we go. Singapore seemed to be relatively unscathed. I mean, we're sort of past that Singapore situation. Our You know, the commuters, the workers who've had to take subways to work, and who got socially isolated and quarantined, unfortunately did it much too late here in New York, and that's why it's been so pervasive. The spread has been rampant.
Yeah, yeah. Just on a, my sister who lives in Europe, she's in Geneva, Switzerland. They're opening things back up around the 27th or 29th of mm-hmm. April.
Yeah.
She has actually scheduled her first massage. She's a big fan of getting regular massages, my sister.
Oh, yeah.
So she's got one scheduled for about, you know, 2 weeks from now. She's very
Ray.
Excited.
I'd settle for a haircut.
She's excited to go get her hair done, too.
I'd settle for a haircut. I look like the wild man of Borneo here.
My husband just looked in the mirror this morning and said, oh, wow. Einstein.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to have to give you a trim. Yeah.
So we, you know, our mayor, Mayor de Blasio, just issued an edict yesterday. He said something to, it sort of reminds me of like the Stasi in East Berlin is like, we have set up a special phone number that you can call if you see any violators of the social distancing, you can call and immediately we will dispatch stormtroopers and we will arrest them.
And yes, we have ways of making you talk. Snitch on your neighbors.
Right. And we have, of course, empty Rikers Island because we emptied it out. We sent all the criminals home because they were at risk of getting it. So we have plenty of places for you violators, you people sitting on park benches too close, or you people who are playing softball. Yes, we have ways of dealing with you.
Yeah. That's very good, Dr. Hopp.
Yeah. Well, so, you know, I don't know how that's going to fly. I mean, this is creating a lot of dissonance because there are the people who are saying, you know, oh, we have to be very disciplined. And then there are other people who are saying, oh, you're just a bunch of sheeple. You're obeying these government dictates. And, you know, it's time to get out and break the quarantine.
True.
And society is really reaching a breaking point here because people are seeing their jobs and their livelihoods melt away. And, you know, it's kind of a risk-benefit equation. So, you know, I'm going to take my chances when it comes to exposure. Unfortunately, though, the repercussions of that are not just a personal repercussions. The repercussions are repercussions to society.
Yes.
And,
yes.
you know, to the healthcare workers who are on the line, who are, you know, courageously working, and also to our, you know, elderly and vulnerable who might, you know. So, you know, it's a really fine line here. It's a kind of... I mean, we've gone from, I mean, it was easier to, in the really early phases of this, to say, okay, this is very serious, let's lock down. Okay, we've locked down. Now what? How do we, you know, now that we have this, created this awareness and paranoia, germ phobia, you know, how mm-hmm. are we going to get back into life again? You know, how mm-hmm. are we going to go to a movie theater or play? You know, I've got Billy Joel tickets for May 2nd. All right. That's not going to happen. That's already been postponed till November 17th. But on November 17th, are we going to want to go to Madison Square Garden, you know, to the big crowd of like 30,000 people and sit, you know, in a space and scream and yell and exhale a lot of potential viral particles into the, you know, inadequate ventilation system there? How are we going to feel about that? You know, that's just something that we have to contemplate.
You know what? That's an interesting question because I fear may be a bigger problem for some people, like almost like a PTSD.
Yeah.
Being afraid to be socially closer, being afraid to, you know, go to an arena, sit at a concert, like you're saying, or even sit next to somebody on the subway anymore, for
example. Exactly. The subways.
New York City subway is a big petri dish anyway.
See, my reaction prior to this was a big crowded subway car, you know, really crowded. Push my way on. Just squeeze in that last little space. You know, if I've got like, you know, a few cubic inches of air, you know, I'm going to shove my way in. Now, I see a crowded subway car, I'm going to say, I'm going to let that go. I'm going to let that go. I'm going to wait till there's like a relatively empty car, you know, and I don't know how that's going to, you know, how we're going to eventually readjust. I mean, the only consolation that I have is that In 1918 and 1919, they had the terrible Spanish flu epidemic. And, you know, people wore masks and people were dying in droves. 675,000 Americans died then. And then, if you look at history, we had something called the Roaring Twenties. So people were like, you know, hanging out at speakeasies and, you know, hugging each other. And it was a time, so it's kind of time of sexual liberation, you know, the wild Charleston dances and things like that.
Yeah.
And, you know, they were singing, "We're in the money," you know.
and it was beautiful fashion. Those dresses of the 1920s, but I digress. Anyway, yeah.
What do you want to get? Your hair bobbed, you know.
No, not the dress fashions.
Like the helmet dresses, hair.
The ladies,
you know, that
wore,
whole thing.
Yeah, the hats they wore. Yeah.
So the point being is that there are cycles in history, and we may be in for a cycle. But then, you know, people's historical memory is very short.
That's true.
And, you know, there are people who experienced the Great Depression, and they're very afraid to spend money. You know, that's like our... you know, parents' generation or maybe our grandparents' generation. And as much money as they accumulate, they sit on it against the possibility that there'll be another calamity. And then there's, you know, people of, you know, millennials, Gen X, and they spend every penny they have on, you know, frivolous entertainments and, you know, experiences and trips and things like that. Saving, that's no biggie because, you know, they've sort of forgotten the message of the Great Depression.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think history goes in cycles, and we have to kind of relearn lessons. And then we, fortunately or unfortunately, forget those lessons. So I think we'll hopefully get past this. You know, I also wanted to just say that one of the themes that I've been hearing a lot about these days, and I've been amplifying that theme, is that, you know, in the absence of a definitive therapy and also in the absence of a vaccine, and I actually have very little hope for the prospects of a vaccine that is A, effective, because effectiveness is the first bar. And, you know, so far, if they had, you know, if effectiveness were the criterion, we would have an effective flu vaccine. Right now, we have a partially effective flu vaccine at best.
Yeah.
There's no AIDS vaccine. There's no cold vaccine. That'd be really nice to have a cold vaccine, and lots of colds are, some colds are rhinoviruses, but some are coronaviruses. So we haven't been able to come up with that. Well, let's say we do come up with an effective vaccine. Will it be safe? That's the other question.
That's right.
And then the other thing is there's a lot of suspicion about vaccines, and some of that's warranted and some of that's irrational. So will we get people to take those vaccines en masse? Bill Gates would have us do that and put little chips in us to verify that we've taken the vaccine. But,
what a frightening thought.
Yeah. I mean, some people think that's going to be the way to go. I don't know.
He's a big vaccine man because his systems are so full of viruses, maybe.
Exactly.
I heard someone on the radio say this morning.
That's sort of, it is paradoxical, but, you know, it's sort of possibly a narrow-minded technological confidence that people of that caliber have. So the point being, I digress, as usual, is that in the absence of definitive treatments or vaccine, what do we have? Well, we have the information that metabolic fitness plays a role in this. Now, there are individuals who seem metabolically fit, and unless something's missing from the picture, they get very sick, and especially when they get a big inoculum of the virus, like a young hospital resident in their 20s or a nurse who comes in contact with somebody who's coughing up big time, lots of viral particles, they get a big, big hit of viral particles and they can get very sick. But for usual people, you're not exposed to that big a viral load. It may be that factors like obesity, diabetes, hypertension, your vitamin D levels, your vitamin A levels, your zinc levels, your level of inflammation, all these may play a role in whether you get sick. And in fact, you know, we do see statistics like, I think in one state it was 75% of the people who were dying were in nursing homes.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's the vulnerable people who are in nursing homes. They can't take care of themselves. People don't go into nursing homes because they're like fun places to play bingo. They go into nursing homes because they can't take care of themselves. They're debilitated.
Yeah.
They need care. Anybody of, you know, sound mind and body is going to say, hey, you know, I'd rather stay home and take care of myself until the very end when, yeah, okay, I'll resort to a nursing home because,
right, because he can't do it anymore. Right.
Yeah. So, you know, this is a call to action, I think, for people to become metabolically fit. The vast
yes.
majority of us are not metabolically fit, according to statistics.
Yeah, I mean, obesity rates, adult overweight rates, all 60%.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
So it's normal is in the minority.
Yeah, and sort of
metabolically healthy is in the minority right now.
An increasing or decreasing minority, you know, as mm-hmm. we become the people who are normal weight and non-diabetic and not on any medications tend to become outliers. Especially as we age. So, you know, that's, I think, something that's going to reinvigorate the practice of integrative medicine. I look forward to getting back into the thick of it when we have a chance to go back into the office whenever those restrictions are lifted. In the meantime, we're doing some phone consultations and some Skype mm-hmm. consultations. They're fun because people enjoy that. You and I are both doing them from mm-hmm. home. And we'll continue doing them and, you know, we'll let listeners know when we're ready to get back in the office. And maybe it's time for, you know, some of you listeners to come and get a metabolic fitness evaluation, see if you can become metabolically fit, because now it's not just a matter of fending off those diseases that might kill us in 20 or 30 years. It's more of a preventive emergency, if that's not an oxymoron, you know, emergency prevention. You know, where you really want to face the coming months and years in a more metabolically fit state. Because again, we can't maintain this lockdown forever. I guess, you know, the most secure thing would be, okay, if not for this nagging fact that we're about to enter another Great Depression, we could all stay home. And that might be the safest thing to do because, you know, nothing happens when you stay home. You know, we could also say the same thing about driving. We could say, let's ban driving over 25 miles per hour. And let's put in a federal law and that nobody can go more than 25 miles per hour. You know, 38,000 people are killed every year on the highways. So if we reduce the speed limit down to 25,000, you know, we probably knock off about 20 or 25,000 deaths. Is it worth it?
You know, no. You could ride your bike faster. I mean, no, exactly.
Yeah, so, you know, these are the big questions.
You can't drive out east at 25 miles an hour. You won't get there. It'll take 3.5 hours.
That would be like going back to the horse and buggy era. You
know? Exactly.
It's like, giddy up, giddy up. It's like, I want to get to my summer house. Oh, that'll take, that'll take a day and a half. So, all right, let's see if we can take some questions. So just a reminder is that we're in the spirit of lifting the lockdown. We're lifting the lockdown on questions. And so in phase one, we're going to take a lot of coronavirus questions, but we'll also take some questions of an ordinary nature. We're doing our part to lift the lockdown here on our weekly Q&A with Layla. It's a sign of the times. Is it safe? Okay, let's tackle some of those questions.
Well, so actually, we've got a couple here, again, about COVID-19. This comes from Alan. I've read that COVID-19 is a protein that soap can, quote, dissolve. Is that true?
The answer is yes. The viral RNA, which is the business end of the virus, is encapsulated in a lipid envelope. And lipids dissolve with soap, just ordinary soap. It happens more readily with warm temperatures, so warm soap and water better than cold soap and water. I think you probably have experienced that when you're trying to clean a greasy dish or pot.
Yes.
Right?
Is that gotta be hot water.
The warm water, you know, those temperatures tend to make the virus or the fat more saponifiable by mm-hmm. soap. It's a chemical reaction where the soap breaks up grease.
As saponins, yes.
Yeah. And mm-hmm. so this does it. The question is, what duration of exposure do you need? Do you just need to slap some soap on it, you know, which is the usual way people wash their hands, or do you need a little more thorough washing? And mm-hmm. so the rule of thumb is do it for 20 seconds. That seems like a very short time, but actually it's pretty long time. I find it, I get kind of impatient washing my hands for 20 seconds.
Right.
Two times, happy birthday to you, you know. So that's the little mnemonic device that we use when we wash our hands these days. And that'll do it. And it's actually, alcohol will do it at a higher concentration. Mm-hmm. I think Clorox Bleach will also do that. But those things are pretty nasty for the hands.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, I saw a guy in the drugstore the other day. I made a foray into a drugstore, and he was buying a big, you know, thing. Your wife, your girlfriend made you go in there. I was trying to make conversation through my mask. And he said, no, he says, for my hands. I wash my hands so much. My hands are all cracked.
Oh, yeah. You know. Washing away the beneficial stuff, too.
Yeah, the beneficial surface oils that are on your hands.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, my hands have changed. I find that they're very slick when I try to hold my iPad. You know, the surface oils usually give it a little traction.
Yeah.
But now the...
now your hands are too clean.
Yeah, my hands are too clean. Yeah. Okay, Layla, at this point, let's pause and allow one of our sponsors an opportunity to share an important message with you. Here goes. This is Dr. Ronald Hoffman with one of my personal solutions to better cardiovascular health, Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Just two capsules of Berkeley Life daily provide the dietary nitrate equivalent of 7 ounces of beets and can support cardiovascular health, maintain healthy blood pressure levels, and improve overall circulation. For more information and to purchase, just go to drhoffman.com/berkeleylife. drhoffman.com/berkeleylife. Berkeley Life Nitric Oxide Support Supplements. Thanks for listening. Thanks for supporting our sponsors. They're what make Intelligent Medicine a continuing free resource to you throughout the current coronavirus pandemic. And now back to our questions. What's next, Layla? Let's hear it.
Alan also says, in the event that this is new information for you, some hospitals are including IV vitamin C in their COVID-19 protocol.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think of that, Dr. Hoffman?
Well, you know, in fact, I'm about to record a podcast today with someone who I believe is probably America's leading authority on intravenous vitamin C, Dr. Jeannie Drisco, who's been a frequent guest here on this program. And we talked earlier this year generally about IV vitamin C, but we're going to talk specifically about experience in relationship to COVID-19. And it's really quite extensive. There's actually a study out of Finland. The administration of vitamin C shortens the lengths of mechanical ventilation in critically ill patients, according to a review recently published in the Journal of Intensive Care.
Wow.
Also, it is not uncommon that in New York hospitals, they're dosing people with vitamin C. They're putting a little bit in the bag. Mm-hmm. Not nearly enough, in my opinion. And there's some trials ongoing in China in particular, where they're using high-dose intravenous vitamin C, you know, 15, 20, 25 grams or more of vitamin C.
That's more like
intravenously.
It.
And that's where vitamin C really may have exert a potent antiviral effect. But I'll let our resident expert render her opinion on what some of these trials are accomplishing. And obviously, you know, we need more research on this. And oh, by the way, the antecedent of that is a guy he's in Norfolk. That's the correct pronunciation of Norfolk, Virginia.
Right? Ah.
That's how they like to pronounce Norfolk. And he's at the hospital down there. His name is, and I'm looking it up, is Dr. Paul Merrick. He's an intensive care specialist at East Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And he wrote a paper summarizing the vitamin's virus-fighting abilities. This is a conventional guy, but he was dealing with something called ARDS, which is slightly different than what's happening. It's not exactly the same thing that's happening to these patients with COVID-19.
Acute respiratory distress syndrome?
Exactly. And that's what they thought this was. This actually looks like it's a little different and distinct from that. But in cases of ARDS, we're frankly... fatality rate is upwards of 50%. You know, once you go into ARDS, you know, chances of emerging from it are, you know, relatively slim.
Yeah.
He was able to save more patients by using a cocktail of a little bit of vitamin B1, a little bit of hydrocortisone, which is a steroid, but steroids don't work alone. They've been tried, you know, those are one of the first things they thought of, just patients need steroids, with high-dose vitamin C. And that cocktail saved a lot of patients. It resulted in some real increased rates of survival in patients.
That's interesting. Vitamin B1 thiamine is important for immunity.
Yes,
you wouldn't normally think of B vitamins being that important for immunity, but apparently thiamine is one.
Yes, it is.
B1.
they all may play a role.
Yeah.
To a certain extent. And, you know, we do know, for example, that alcoholic patients who are running around, you know, on the Bowery, they're malnourished, they're panhandling. And when they come into the hospital, the first intervention is a nutritional intervention. They're given a shot of vitamin B1 because many of them have hallmarks of a nutritional deficiency called beriberi, which is vitamin B1 deficiency. So it causes them to have brain problems, Wernicke-Korsakoff syndrome.
Yes.
Confusion,
irritability, unable to put a sentence together.
And it's not just the booze. It's actually, I mean,
the lack of
B1. Part of it. It's the lack
of B1. B1.
Yeah. Enough on that, but we'll do a podcast on that subject. We'll probably release it, you know, this week, and look for that podcast on IV vitamins. A lot of people are asking me, you know, what about IV vitamin C? What about IV vitamin C? Unfortunately, the politics of medicine and the economics of medicine make it hard to administer IV vitamin C. We'll also find out why so few trials are being undertaken in the United States. I mean, not a lot of, frankly, money to be made off that, but, you know, you would think that even a therapy that's not marketable would be something that they'd want to prioritize.
You would think so.
Of good treatments.
Right.
Yeah.
In the meantime, Dr. Hoffman, we've got a really nice email all the way from Botswana.
That's a good tease. Can you save it for part two? Because we
brought
our podcast into part two.
Part two already. I don't know where part one flew to, but here we are.
Here we are. Okay. So let's tell our listeners to go to part two. And in part two, we'll answer some questions of, you know, on our usual types of questions, as well as take a comment from one of our faithful listeners in Botswana? Whoa, that's pretty cool. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and today's with Layla Mudin, who's our nutritionist in residence. It's our weekly Q&A with Layla. We'll be right back.